Well-Tempered Baroque is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is provided by listener members like you. Support this show by becoming a member of the Classical Network at wwfm.org. Thank you. This is Well-Tempered Baroque, and I'm Dr. Lewis Barretts. Last week, we explored the music of the Stilus Fantasticus, the virtuosic, sometimes bizarre style of instrumental music prevalent at the court of Vienna, in Venice, and in the more fashionable German states from around 1630 to 1660. This coincides with the rise of the virtuoso player. Indeed, many of these virtuosos were themselves composers, writing music that enabled them to show off their capabilities. And conversely, composers wrote rhapsodic and highly charged music that challenged their violinist and cornetist colleagues to push their technique to its maximum potential. Today on Well-Tempered Baroque, we have two guests who are spiritual descendants of the virtuoso Fantasticus players of the 17th century. With me, down from Boston this week, are Nathaniel Cox, a rising star cornetist, and Alan Hamrick, who specializes in the Dulcian and Baroque and classical bassoons. Welcome, gentlemen, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Lewis.
Thank you.
Nathaniel and Alan, you're both living in Boston and both considered rising stars in the early music field, and both play relatively obscure instruments. And as I understand, you both just met yesterday?
That's right. We just drove down from Boston last night for the concerts this weekend in Princeton and in New Hope, Pennsylvania.
Don't forget to invite your listeners, Lewis.
I certainly will invite them, and at the end of our show today. Alan, you play the Dulcian, Baroque bassoon, classical bassoon, and modern bassoon also?
Yes, that's correct.
So what are the essential differences between the Dulcian and the Baroque and the classical bassoon?
Yeah, so that's a question I get very often. Most, if not all, bassoons after about 1680 were made from several different pieces of wood. Mm-hmm. Instrument makers would ream the inside of each piece, and this technique gave them control over the exact shape of the inside of the instrument, of the bore. And this was something the Hautetert family was charged with accomplishing for King Louis XIV, and it was a primary innovation that solidified the bassoon's place in the orchestra for the coming ages. Doing this allowed the bassoon to play fairly soft, to blend with violins and flutes, but it could also be heard above a small orchestra to play concerti. As the 18th century progressed and we entered the classical era, instrument makers further finessed the inside bore to provide for greater expression and lyricism that characterizes music of C.P. Bach and Mozart and even Beethoven. Also, in this classical period, more keys were added to allow the bassoon to play more chromatically, and in other keys aside from C major and B flat major, D minor, etc.
So, question for you. So, for example, in the classical bassoon versus the modern bassoon, how many different pieces of metal are we talking about?
The modern bassoon has anywhere from about 22 or 23 different keys to close different holes. The classical bassoon has anywhere from 7 to 9. So the Dulcian, in contrast with the Baroque and classical bassoons, has even less metal. And the method of constructing the instrument was also different. So rather than being made from several different pieces of wood, the Dulcian was made from a single piece of wood. And instrument makers would drill two parallel holes into the single piece, and then they would ream opposite cones to create a sort of contiguous bore. They would use various methods to shape the outside of the body to allow it to fit into the musician's hands. And as a result, instrument makers didn't have the same degree of control as later instrument makers of the Baroque and classical bassoons. And then you also have two pieces of metal, so two keys that were added to allow holes that were not close to the player's hands to influence the actual lattice of the tone holes.
So, and Dulcians came in different sizes, whereas the bassoon was mainly a low tenor or a bass instrument?
In fact, the role of the bassoon is kind of tied in with this, whether it's a bass instrument or even as early as Rameau uses it as an alto instrument. The dulcian could be in a consort of 3 to 5 different sizes, but we also have some evidence that that number could be as large as 7 different sizes.
What are some of the differences in the approach or the technique between the dulcian, let's say, and the bassoon of 1680?
The music of the dulcian, most of it was scalar, so it means the music just goes by step. There are very few leaps, and when there are, it's usually in intervals like a fifth or an octave.
Let's hear something. What about the Fantasia of Bartolomeo de Selma e Salaverda that you and I recorded this morning?
Yeah. Sounds like a good choice.
Bartolomeo de Selma e Salaverda was a Spanish composer who was a dulcian player at the Innsbruck court of the Archduke Leopold of Austria. This piece is from a collection that he dedicated to Leopold in 1638, and this is something that Alan and I just recorded this morning so you guys could hear a real live sound, and you'll actually hear the clicking of that one or two keys, which is part of the characteristic of the instrument. Thank you. That was a little live sample that Alan Hamrick and I did of the Fantasia No. 10 of Bartolomeo de Selma y Salaverda. Alan, I'd like to contrast this with the Baroque bassoon. What do you have for us?
So I have a sample from my master's degree recital I did at Juilliard several years ago. This was part of the historical performance requirements there. It's a sonatina by Georg-Philipp Telemann. It was originally written for violin, but it's been adapted for bassoon. And then I have some Juilliard colleagues with me on cello and harpsichord.
Now, give us a few pointers on what to listen for in terms of bassoon sound as opposed to dulcian sound.
The Baroque bassoon has a darker and richer sound to it than the dulcian has. The dulcian sound was meant to be heard from a great distance when it was used in military bands, as opposed to the concert hall use for the Baroque bassoon. Also listen for melodic differences. The bassoon melodies jump between octaves more rapidly and easily than the dulcian does.
You know, when I heard this piece for the first time, I know you mentioned violin, but I'm thinking recorder. In general, this is a late Baroque work with several movements and a more structured form instead of a single movement work like we heard earlier. A live recording of Alan Hamrick Baroque bassoon in a sonatina of Telemann.
Thank you.
That was my guest Alan Hamrick performing a sonatina of Georg Philipp Telemann on Baroque bassoon, a live recording from his master's recital at the Juilliard School of Music from 2 years ago. Now let's leave the dark nether regions of sound and turn to the instrument that was said to be the perfect substitute for the human voice. This was the solo instrument par excellence, the instrument that gave the early violin a run for its money, the cornetto. Nathaniel, what are we listening to?
That's a canzona, a multi-sectional instrumental piece by Girolamo Frescobaldi, published in Rome in 1628. I recorded this in Switzerland with organist Aki Noda.
Hey, let's hear the whole thing now. We're talking with cornetist Nathaniel Cox, who we just heard performing a canzona of Frescobaldi. Nathaniel, the sound of the cornetto is wonderful and it's unique. It's been described as a woodwind that thinks it's a brass. It appears as a loud band or alto cappella instrument around 1550, but by 1600 it becomes a premier solo instrument. How is that sound produced?
So the actual tone production is similar to a brass instrument. It has a cup-shaped mouthpiece that you vibrate the lips into, so it gets a bit of a brassy color that way, but the actual instrument is made of wood, and it's not terribly dissimilar from a recorder or a sham or oboe or another woodwind instrument in terms of the finger holes and the shape of the bore.
What's the mouthpiece actually made out of?
It's usually made of horn. Sometimes it's made of hardwood like ebony or palisandro.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're getting a lot of attention as a rising virtuoso player, which is not bad for a young guy.
Thanks.
But how did you discover the cornetto, or how did the cornetto discover you?
I did my undergraduate studies at Oberlin College and Conservatory. I was a Russian studies and modern trumpet major, and I'd played the trumpet since I was 10. But once I started to focus as a performance major at Oberlin, I realized that the trumpet really wasn't what I wanted to do. And I was kind of looking for other ways to make the music that I really wanted to make. So I happened to hear a fantastic cornetto player, Bruce Dickey, who performed in Oberlin with his ensemble Concerto Palatino. And this was the first that I'd heard the cornetto, the first I'd really experienced. I didn't really know what it was or what it could do, but I was just amazed by the beauty of the instrument. I loved the type of music that it played. I was just won over by this 17th century sound, you know, and also Bruce's amazing musicality and technique was just incredible. So I approached Bruce after the concert, and he agreed to give me a lesson. He kind of got me started, showed me how to hold the thing. One of the initial challenges to the cornetto is the finger holes are very widely spaced. So just covering the holes with your fingers requires either very large hands or very uncomfortable finger stretches. So he successfully taught me how to hold the instrument in the first lesson. So he suggested that I keep with it, and we kept in touch. The following summer, he got me to be the artist in residence at a music festival that he was teaching at in San Francisco, and then he suggested that I come study with him in Basel, Switzerland.
And the rest is history.
That's right. Yeah, so I graduated from Oberlin. I got a Fulbright scholarship to study at the Schola Cantorum in Basel, Switzerland.
Fantastic place with fantastically unique opportunities.
Absolutely, and unique people from all over the world.
Let's hear some more. This is a set of diminutions on the 16th century madrigal Ancor che col partire, Though in Leaving You, I Feel Myself Die. You don't have a composer listed here, but it sounds a lot to me like Giovanni della Casa or Francesco Ragnoni, the virtuoso transitional style of around 1590.
Thank you. That was the intention.
Okay, I'm blushing.
So this is a diminution piece in the style of the 1590s to 1600s. I actually wrote these diminutions myself, and I was heavily influenced by the style of Francesco Ragnoni and also Giovanni Battista Bovicelli. One of the things that we were really encouraged to do in Basel was not just to play old music, but to actually make our own music in these styles. And through doing this, we were able to really internalize these musical styles. Aki Noda is also the organist on this as well.
Great, thanks. Thank you. So we heard cornetist Nathaniel Cox and organist Aki Noda in an arrangement of a madrigal by the 16th century composer Cipriano Durore that Nathaniel did himself at Switzerland. And of course, at Basel, you got to do a lot of chamber music with a lot of fun instruments.
Absolutely. Small ensemble music is some of the most satisfying music making. You really have to take ownership of your part and of the entire product.
Now, we have a Galliard that demonstrates this.
Yeah, this Galliard was actually written by a friend of mine, Elam Rotem, who also studied at the Scola in Basel. And he directs the amazing vocal ensemble Profeti della Quinta.
Yeah, they are amazing.
So he wrote this while we were in Basel together. He was very heavily influenced by the 17th century style of Salomone Rossi and Claudio Monteverdi, but it has its own character too, while still sounding, I think, like authentic 17th century music.
Fabulous cornetto playing by Nathaniel Cox. You both have had conventional conservatory training. Nathaniel at Oberlin and Alan at North Carolina School of the Arts before moving on to specialize in early music performance at the Scola Cantorum Baseliensis and Juilliard respectively. Tell me some of the technical differences or difficulties you first encountered or what you found between your modern instruments and then turning to period instruments.
With bassoon, the first thing that I personally noticed was just in holding the instrument. Obviously, the modern bassoon, as I said before, has a ton of keys on it, which help it play in chromatic remote keys and also very high. And so the fingering system is much different on Baroque bassoon as it is on modern bassoon. But there's a more subtle difference as well, and you find that when you form the embouchure and with the support for the instrument. Contrasting that with the Baroque bassoon, you have to do some of these things, but it doesn't take as much effort. So on the Baroque bassoon, the reed is a little bit wider, so you don't have to work as hard with your embouchure to create that same kind of seal.
How many hours a day or a week do you spend on reed making?
Oh, not enough. theoretically, I should be spending at least an hour or 2 hours every day working on reeds and finessing reeds.
Nathaniel, do you still play modern trumpet at all?
No, I haven't really touched the modern trumpet in many, many years. I haven't actually felt the need to. I keep pretty busy with all the musical activities I'm involved in.
Now, you both have second instruments as well that you currently play. Alan, a third, because you play dulcian and bassoon. You also play recorder.
Yes, that's correct. I'm really looking forward to playing those great big recorders with you this weekend.
Yeah, the great bass. Hopefully, I'll have my finger stretched out by tomorrow. And Nathaniel, your second instrument?
Yes, I'm also a theorbo player.
So what a combination. Cornetto and theorbo, so you literally have all bases covered.
Yeah, as far as I know, that's a pretty unique combination of instruments, but it is fascinating to approach the music both as a melody instrument player and as a continuo player. It's the same music, but you're approaching it with a very different perspective.
Now, a really good way to learn basso continuo is to find a good singer to work with.
Yeah, that was one of my first priorities when I was learning theorbo. I wanted to find someone who was a great singer and a great sight reader, but also someone who was friendly and forgiving enough to put up with me as a beginning theorbo player. So I found the soprano Agnes Coakley, and we started working together, and we very quickly developed a very tight professional and romantic relationship that's been almost 6 years now.
Fantastic. So let's hear some of you together. This is Nathaniel Cox on theorbo now with soprano Agnes Coakley. This is the song Man's Mortality by the English 17th century composer Henry Lawes. Man's Mortality by the 17th century English composer Henry Lawes. Agnes Coakley, soprano, with Nathaniel Cox now on Theorbo. I hope everyone noticed the old pronunciation of English, with its wonderful vowel colors, its rhyme scheme, its puns, all of which are lost in today's English. One more thing. Nathaniel told me before we recorded this that he actually had borrowed a theorbo and a lute, and he also has a very special answer to that age-old question, what did you do over your summer vacation?
Well, yes, I built a lute.
All of us, I'm sure, have built a lute at one point during our summer vacations.
Oh, well, it's what you do. So my father is a violin maker, and so I grew up as the son of an instrument builder, surrounded by wood and tools. So when I decided that the theorbo is great, but I should also play the lute in terms of building my technique, my first instinct was actually, well, why don't I just build one? So I mentioned this to my dad as a possible project, and he said it sounded great. So I came home from Switzerland for the summer, and we had about 3.5 weeks, and we worked basically night and day, and we put together a lute, and the first surprise was when it didn't fall apart, and the second surprise was when it actually sounded pretty good. I took it back and played it for a lot of my colleagues in Switzerland, and they were very, very encouraging. So I kind of took it from there, and I've been building lutes for the past 3 years now. I've had a couple professional commissions, but I'm also just building a lot of instruments that I'm interested in playing myself.
Okay, so we have time for one more clip of you and Agnes with some of your classmates or colleagues from Scuola Cantorum Basiliensis in Switzerland. This is the song Io mi son giovinetta of Luzzasco Luzzaschi.
Thank you.
We heard soprano Agnes Coakley with Nathaniel Cox on cornetto and some of their colleagues at the Schola Cantorum Basel. This is Well-Tempered Baroque, and I'm Dr. Louis Barrett. I'm here with dulcian player and early bassoonist and recorder player Alan Heimrich and cornetist, theorbist Nathaniel Cox, two very impressive young musicians of the new generation of early music performers. Alan and Nathaniel are here from Boston this week and are guest artists with La Fioco Period Instrument Ensemble. We'll be performing music of the Fantastica style tomorrow, that's Saturday, April 1st, at United Methodist Church in Princeton at 7:30 p.m. and on Sunday, April 2nd at 3 p.m. at Trinity Episcopal Church in Solbury, Pennsylvania, just outside of New Hope. Information on these concerts is available at the La Fioco website at www.lafioco.org. That's www.lafioco.org. You gentlemen have talked about your musical inspirations, so let me share with you and our listeners a recording that I found very inspiring. Nathaniel, I'm sure you know this. This is Lodovico Viadana's Sinfonia La Bolognese for 8 players and Giovanni Gabriele's Canzona 2 for 6. This is Il Concerto Palatino da Bologna. Bruce Dickey, your former teacher, director.
Thank you.
We heard a Sinfonia La Bolognese for 8 players by Lodovico Viadana, and the Canzona No. 2 for 6 players by Giovanni Gabrielli, Il Concerto Palatino da Bologna, Bruce Dickey, director. Let's hear one more sample of Bruce Dickey. I mean, the playing is just so incredible. It inspired Nathaniel, it inspired me, it inspired an entire generation. This is Claudio Morula, Canzona No. 23 for 5 players. Again, Il Concerto Palatino da Bologna, Bruce Dickey, cornetto, and ensemble leader. So besides the La Fioco concert, what's coming up next for you guys?
In a couple weeks, I'll be playing in New York City with the Trinity Wall Street Baroque Orchestra. We'll be doing Handel's Israel in Egypt. In a couple weeks after that, I will be returning to this area to play with Grand Harmony. We'll be doing some Mozart. The info for that performance is on the Grand Harmony website at grandharmony.org. That's Grand, H-A-R-M-O-N-I-E.
And next week I'm putting my Theorbo hat back on. I'm doing a residency with the vocal ensemble Gravitation. And then later in the month I'm flying out to Austin to do the Monteverdi Vespers with the Texas Early Music Project.
Great. So I hope some well-tempered Baroque listeners in New Jersey and Pennsylvania can come hear these guys with La Fioco tomorrow in Princeton or Sunday in Solbury, Pennsylvania. For information on the concert, visit La Fioco's website at lafioco.org. And that's our show for today. And speaking of websites, if you enjoyed today's program, consider becoming a donor or member of the Classical Network. Visit us online at wwfm.org. I'm Dr. Lewis Barrett. Have a great week.